get an office?
This year. But I only asked for one this year. Okay. Let's start off following up on one point from last Chabura. So Isaac listened to the Chabura. He told me he agreed with Yair's point that the Rambam is for sure not making a conceptual point. He's interested in a different question. He's just interested in the order of the Septuagint, and that doesn't really take a stance on whether Nezek that arises in Bava Metzia is qualitatively similar or different from Nezek arising in Bava Kama. So that was Isaac's Ha'ara. I want to call your attention to the Rambam's formulation in his Pirtei HaMitzvos, so his Koteretz to the different Halachos. So the first that we have here is Koteret to Hilchos Nezikin. The second is the Koteret to Hilchos... I'm sorry. First is the Koteret to Sefer Nezikin. The second is the Koteret to Sefer Shoftim. Mishpatim. So what is the Rambam saying? Oh, here, here. Hey, yeah, here. Hey, here. Hi, how are you? Good. So the first thing we have here is Rambam, the Koteret to Hilchos Nezikin, Sefer Nezikin. The second is the Koteret to Sefer Mishpatim. So what does the Rambam do here? So, Donnie, why don't you read for us the Sefer Nezikin one?
You read it, or?
Yeah, sure. Sefer
Efel Bola Mitzvos. Shame, Sefer Zeh. Right. So the Rambam's characterization of Nezikin is something that Yesh Behen Hezek Tchila. Okay? Contrast that with how he describes Sefer Mishpatim. So, Ben, on your read for us. Yes. So, the Rambam says that Sefer Mishpatim is about interpersonal relationships. Bishar dinim she'en b'tchilas on hezeh. Now, do you think this is similar to the Yuri that we saw on Tuesday, or is there a nuance of a difference? So here's the Miri's formulation. Sorry. Do you want to go back and look at the Miri's formulation for a second? Here's the Rambam. We go back to the Meiri. Is the Meiri. What are your thoughts?
The formulations are very similar.
So they're similar, somewhat.
Although it sounds like the Meiri says that there's low Shalomi Hezek. That one has to think, well, there are also like there is Hezek, but if there is Hezek, there's not Meiri.
Oh, so that's the nuance of the idea that I want to make. But I think Yair is right that they look, you know, it sounds like Rambam is getting at something similar. You know, one's Nezek, one's not Nezek based. But I think Yoni's right, and this is what I had in mind, is that the crucial word here is she'en b'tchilasan Nezek in the Rambam. So it is these torts, or let's say damage arising under Bava Metzia, is also a kind of Nezek. Just the
They don't begin as pure nezek. It's nezek that arises under some sort of special relationships. So if the tchilasan hezek, even though it is b'sofo hezek, just you need the antecedent relationship to frame the hezek. And that's different from the Meiri who characterized Bava Metzia as non-nezek. I think this diet works nicely with this, my suggestion on Tuesday, that the Rambam sees the relationship between Bava Kama and Bava Metzia as a continuum. So here, am I splitting hairs, or...?
No, you persuaded me.
Well,
you persuaded
me. It's a diet.
It's a
diet,
but it's
you can
go.
Yes.
Where is the second word?
So these are the... This is the Rambam in the end. In the beginning of Mishnah Torah, he has an overview of the different svarim are. And this is where he just characterizes.
Oh, right.
So it's... You have to look at that. Like, I'm not sure if it's officially part of the end of Sefer Mishnah, but I think it's really the end of the Hakdama.
He's characterizing svarim in Mishnah Torah.
His svarim, yeah.
So which Sefer...
Exactly. So Sefer Shlosha Asar is Mishpatim, and Sefer Achad Asar is Mizikin. That's my idea. So I think that works nicely with the analysis from Tuesday. Let me, for completion's sake, let me call our attention to another Rambam. Here, I think we get a slightly different impression. I'll sow the seed now, but we'll come back to it later. So here are the Rambams in Mor Nebuchim. Yakir, are you there?
Yakir? So I emailed out this updated report. Should you just email it to you right now so you can see the Rambams? Just send it out.
Perfect.
Yeah, I didn't send it out there once. Let me just send this out for 1 second.
You also said we should invest. Yakir's going to call it every day.
I mean, get like some sort of.
Okay,
yeah. Okay. So maybe we'll do that.
We only have enough money for that, or should you shop
or something? No, maybe we could do a Zoom or something.
Yeah.
No?
So interesting.
That's
all the
money
that
so I have to. Yeah, I'm sorry. No, we have to change to the Google Doc. Let me just forward this to you here for a second. Okay, Yakir, I forwarded it to you, but I'll send it out later.
My only issue with Google Docs is I have to figure out how to
update it when I'm not online. Is it easy to do that?
Yeah, so you
can
click
the button. Yeah. Okay. Fine, you'll show me after the Chabura to do it. How to do it. So here are the other Rambams I wanted to call your attention to. Sorry. So if you look, so yeah, the Rambam in Mor Nebuchim and Chelek Gimel Perek Mem, and then also Chelek Gimel Perek Mem Beis. Perek Mem is where the Rambam describes Sefer Nezikim. Perek Mem Beis is where the Rambam describes Sefer Mishpatim. So most of Bava Metzia is in Mishpatim.
So
just look what the Rambam says then. So Nezikim, Vehem Kulam Behasara Sa'avel. Umanoa hahezek. Right, so again, this is the Rambam consistent with what we saw yeah.
On Tuesday. The Zigan is about deterrence, right? Removing or deterring, preventing damage. And because it's so important to deter or remove damage, so the Torah makes you liable. Right, we saw the Rambam in Mor Nebuchim last year also. Here, the Rambam almost has an economic view. The significance of tort liability, right? The point of liability in the Zigan is minias ahezek, to prevent damages.
In Perek Mem Beis, the Rambam discusses the Bava Metzia topics, and what does he say? So, Yair, you want to read this for us? I was going to ask Yoni, but you know.
Yakir, I would ask you, but your books look like I think that your apples are blueberries.
I'm just going to call it Shvi. The name of the moment is Simar Nubit Sase, the Shvatim, the Sase, the Kinnan, the Sibatan of the Guarat. Zeshahim Shur Mishpati Yoshev Asakim Hanim.
Yeah, I'd say maybe Hem Shiur Mishpate Yosher.
Yeah,
נמצא את זה. בעסקים, יגון, הנהוגים בין...
שיעזרו המוסקים את זה, את זה, להוביל כל אחד החבר, לא שיהיה אחד אחד משני המוסקים לרב וחלקו בכל, בכל, שיעדו המרוויח בכל הצד.
Good.
And Rambam goes on to detail this, you know, say that's why the Torah of this regulation on how much you can charge, like onah laws. And then he even talks about shomrim. So you can see what you're about to talk about the shomrim.
Let me just... Which is paradigmatic of Mitzia topics. And what does the Rambam say? So continue, Yair.
This is
Yeah, v'chol nezek she'yara, whatever, humi kis balamamo.
Right.
Right. So look, Hashem Rechinam is doing a performing gratuitous service. Right. He's performing a chesed. So that the equitable liability rule is that the mafkid should bear most liability. Right. And he says, "Ofania yosher b'mavur." Right. I'm sorry, we skipped Shoel, right?
We just skipped Shoel.
Shoel shatoelas kula shalo. Right. So you see. Yes. Yeah, and et cetera. So,
what strikes you about the Rambam's short description of the Bava Metzia rules, even his example about Shomrim, in contrast to his characterization of the Nezikin rules?
I mean, the ring appeals to like greatness. Like, it's fair that the shomer, that the shoel should be responsible for every, for the benefit that he's getting. He's gaining some benefits and he's responsible for the damage. It's fair that the shomer chima shouldn't be responsible.
Yes, exactly. As opposed to the Nezikin rules,
which are, you know, economic or return.
Yes, isn't that interesting? Just like if you just take an obvious characterization of Martin Luther, it sounds like he's wearing a different hat for the different.
How do you see it for the
Zikin
that it's more,
it's
not
20 spaces? So he just says that, Kulam Bahasara Sa'avel Umanoa Hezek. Kulurov Bahasara Umaniyasa Hezek, Kai Kodam Kol Hezek Shiavo Bimamona. So why am I liable to you if I cause you harm? Because the Torah wants to determine, the Torah wants to prevent me from causing damage in the first place. So it sounds like the Rambam saying the liability rules of Nezikin are to create a society that maximally deter damage. That's not what the Rambam says when it comes to above Metzia topics. The Rambam there says that this is all about like fairness in commercial relationships. And he gives you the examples of the Shomer Zafar versus the Shoel and what's the equitable rule for these different kinds of relationships. So this is slightly in tension with the way we've been seeing the Rambam until now. Right? Until now, I was trying to suggest that Rambam sees Bava Metzia just as a natural continuation of Bava Kama, just this liability that arises under a special relationship, so it's stronger toward. Here, in Mordechai Luchim, you get the sense that the Rambam has a different way of approaching or conceiving of Bava Kama, which is this economic orientation to maximally deter damage, versus this more rights-based fairness way of going about Bava Metzia,
which is about fair pricing and fair interactions and burdens for Shomer.
Would that be like the natural continuation? Like, as you go from like more economic approach between two people who don't have an interaction with each other and have a relationship, then as you move towards this relationship that's like an actual, like,
then you have to get more fairness.
Is that right? So it could, yeah, be still, like, it's still,
yeah, I could see that's a nice way to try to resolve the.
As you rise up levels, things have to change. Like, yeah. Your approach has to change as well.
I think it's a nice way to resolve the tension. I think, but still, like, you know, if the framework could be totally clean, then you'd expect that, you know, oh, they're both rights-based or something, they're just different modalities of severeness, or they're both economic-based, just right. Different. Right. So I think it's a nice way to try to resolve the tension. It's a good suggestion.
Ben, do you have a comment on this? You look very pensive.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what do you think about it?
I don't disagree.
You have to look so pensive just to come to a conclusion that you don't disagree. Yoni, any thoughts?
No, I feel like that.
Okay. Donnie? Okay. Good. So that's what I wanted to
wrap up from last time.
We had started discussing the outline of the Masechta. So we went through most of it. I just want to go a little more slowly through the last few things before we move on. So we spoke about the first topic is contracts, and we gave a nice outline of the contracts questions. Part of the contract discussion, I slightly rearranged this, is, you know, what are you not able to contract in? So like Asnatha and the Rajin of Rishusa was an interesting question in Halakha, that maybe you can't enter into agreements about things that are not yet yours. That's a big problem because most of commercial agreements relate to goods and services that are not yet in your possession. So Asmata raises interesting questions about the nature of contract and halakha. Then we have there's a whole discussion about employment relationships. Yad Poel Kiyad Balabais. This is to what extent does the employer own the labor of the employee? This we'll talk about part of our early discussion as Sofar Somnim. What rights does a poel have to back out of an agreement without penalty? So you'll see this is something to consider, that the halacha is between like the employer's rights and the employee's rights. Where do you think the halacha falls? Yeah, I mean, the Rebbe Dosa and...
Yeah.
Yes. Machlokes in the Gemara, we paskin more that poel is yochel lachzor, which is a huge boon to the poel. So we'll see it in this discussion. The halacha gives the poel enormous rights to back out, even at costs to his employer. Again, the poel has rights to eat food from his employer while he's doing work in the land. The Torah imposes duty on the employer to make sure to pay on time. What's that, Yannick?
Power of 99%.
You're saying the workers.
Yeah,
the
workers.
Yeah, it's worker friendly.
Yeah. I spoke about it like Zechus Poel Lachzar in Englewood, and the people that were very upset about that. Where the halacha came down. Yeah. Although we'll see here, the halacha does have some very strong things to say about a poel's duty not to moonlight if his moonlighting will prevent him from maximizing his productivity during his employment hours. So all these fall under the general category of what duties does an employee have to his employer and what duties does the employer have to the employee. That's a large part of the Masechta, and we'll talk about it within our discussion of the contracts. But I see the employment relationship as a subset of the broader contract discussion. A third area within the contract discussion is general schiros issues. So for example, at the end of the Masechta, the Gemara discusses when are you allowed to evict a tenant in schiros batim cases? What kind of notice do you have to give him before you raise rent or kick him out? Does the tenant or the landlord, between them, who has the responsibility to repair structural damage to the home. Stuff like that. So that's about general lesser lessee tenant landlord relationships, and that's really covered in the end of the Masechta. Similarly, if you're a sharecropper, so let's say Yair gives me his field to work, so long as I pay him a percentage of the profits, well, what duties do I have to actually ensure that there are profits? Do I have a right to say, well, I'm not interested in working, you're entitled to 30%, 30% of zero is zero. So part of the sector tries to figure out, between a landlord and a tenant, what duties can I have to the landlord and vice versa. The other big area of the Masechta is Shomrim. So we'll have a lot to say when we get there. This I outlined, I think, pretty nicely in the last year, so I'm not going to go over the general Shomrim question. We spoke about Kol Tnai Shebimamon is Kayim. Right, so it sounds like in the Mamonist parties can arrange any conditions that they want. What are your intuitions on this? Is that a plausible rule that Kol Tnai Shebimamon Kayim and the Tchura's rules are just default rules? Or do you think that parties should be constrained by the Torah's default categories? And Yoni, what do you?
I mean, I feel like it relates to, like, nowadays a lot of like companies that have like certain contracts that people don't read. So it's like, on one hand, like, you should go sign whatever you want, but
yeah,
like, good. That's like, unfair, like price gouging.
Yeah. Good. That's like a slightly different issue. That's really. Part of the contract-related question about unconscionability, meaning if you enforce parts of an agreement that are really unconscionable, meaning it's clear that the signer didn't really understand what the terms were, or only agreed under unfair bargaining conditions. So we'll talk about that. I mean, you might say that's one reason why you wouldn't allow the whole time to kind of what you're suggesting. But I mean, in general, is it reasonable that in the game of this party should be able to make any
time
that they want?
I mean, there are limitations, you know, Ona's limitation, Ribbis' limitation, there are things we can do, the Torah doesn't include those.
Right, Ribbis is a good exception. Ona is a little tricky, because maybe you can explicitly be Mochel Ona. Sorry, to make it tonight that there's no Ona on this bargain.
Even Ribbis.
What?
Even Ribbis.
Well, but not through tonight.
Yeah.
But you need some other mechanism. So this raises a really interesting question. Kol Tnai Shebimamon Kayim. The most relevant case where this comes up nowadays is when parties have an agreement. And oftentimes they have a choice of law clause. Anybody know what that is? Donnie, you're the aspiring lawyer. Yeah, well, your clerkship with...
I can do more on matrimonial law.
Well, even in matrimonial law, it's an interesting question. Because sometimes you have prenups that will have a governing law provision that says this contract should be interpreted in accordance with the laws of the state of New York. So people come to Bezdin all the time, don't have a contract or an operating agreement that says this agreement should be interpreted according to the laws of the state of New York or New Jersey if they're from Tina. So, is that binding? So does that mean that the rules for resolving their dispute should be New York law rather than Jewish law? So some people think, yes, Kol Tnai Shebimamon Kayim. And here you have a bona fide Tanai saying the rules of the dispute resolution process should appeal to New York law principles. It's a Tanai between the parties, and they're free to make that Tanai.
Does that work legally?
I think on like a, yeah, between like a two parties,
so
civil.
They just go abide by like one random state?
Yeah.
If you go to New Jersey, can say we want to abide by the laws of the state of Ohio?
I think so. It's like a, how they want their sweet years off. As like a private law matter between the two of them.
Right.
Or an exemption from like any criminal stuff. Right. So you think that should work here in law?
on the Tisha B'Av.
Well,
you're saying maybe that's, maybe that's a good application of Kol Tanai Shel Mamun Kayin. Does that sound like problematic or?
Well, we call it.
Well,
I think it's like a college.
I think then it's just like, what's the point of
Jewish
laws or
what's the basis
for
everything?
Well,
what's the basis for everything?
Well, some people think that even if you have that provision, but yeah, both of them are slightly separate because no one's saying that you can do that and still have a secular court for it.
Yeah, but I think the point of the Jewish court is not just about like who the court is, but also like what the law is.
Okay, so then why should you be allowed to have a Shomer Safar who makes a T'nai that his liability rule is a Shomer Bina?
Only you can have like a certain leeway, you know, like totally
not totally.
Okay,
that's just a question of degree, right?
Right, yeah.
So that's really this underlying question of the Kol Tanai Shel Mamun Kayin question. Related to that, we said, is the Kol Kamina Gamadina question. So here we'll see halacha defers very often to the commercial custom.
Does anybody know what's going on in this Sigya and so this, in Bavimitsiya and Bavimitsiya and Bavimitsiya?
So what's going on there is the Gemara talks about cases where you have a ksuva, it specifies the amount of the payout that's due upon divorce or death. But the Gemara says the custom in that town is to inflate the amount of the ksuva payment. So what's the payout? So it's customary for them to inflate it by, let's say, 100%. So if the husband intends to pay out $1,000, so they're right, oh, the husband pledges... the husband really pledging 500. Sorry, if he intends to pay 1,000, he pledges 2,000. Right, the ksuba says 2,000.
But he'll actually only pay one?
Right. Well, the custom is to write double the amount of the intended liability.
Right. I wasn't sure if you meant the custom is to double the ksuba payment or double the number.
So the Gemara talks about both cases. The Gemara talks about both cases, right? Okay. It's the. So, I mean, what do you do in that case? Do you follow the language of the ksuva, or do you follow the custom of the town?
Intuitively, you're asking?
Yeah. So you have a document, right? It says the husband will pay $2,000 upon divorce. Let's make it more realistic. He says, I'll pay $100,000 if we get divorced.
But the custom is to inflate it by a factor of
three. What do you mean by custom? Like it's like in the law in that area? Or
just the practice?
Not all practice, no.
What?
It's all practice, like the estate.
Right? Practice. That's the thing Mara seems to say. The Mara's like Kol Kamina Gamadina over there.
So there's probably a good reason. There was that in the Talmud, it was probably created for a reason. There's probably a good reason for it.
Well, I don't even think it's that. I don't think it's that there was a reason behind the Minhag. It's just that. Presumably, this is what the
laws.
This is what the contract intends to convey.
Right.
Yeah.
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 Just like it's a philosophy of language question.
Yes.
If the number two in the context of contract
means one,
means one.
Right.
Then
good. So you see, Minhag is a powerful. It's a powerful force.
Yeah.
In other
what's the scale of the Minhag?
Right. How do you?
No one who doesn't do that.
Yeah, it's a good question. How do you quantify what's a real minhag versus just like a...
Doesn't this make it somewhat more messy?
Well?
Doesn't the concept of taking minhag just be the legal system? Like,
yes. Well, I guess in some areas it makes it less complicated because you could just defer to the minhag.
Well, like in a lot of things, like there's got to be going conflicts like historically about my minhag is this, my minhag is that.
Right. Right, which minhag do you... I'll tell you about an interesting case which turns on trying to figure out the right minhag. So, remind me to come back to that. So, look, the Gemara also talks about cases where there's a strong custom for workers to eat from their employer's storage houses, even in cases where they're not halakhically entitled to.
They're only allowed from the field, right?
Halakhically.
Yeah.
Halakhically is only from the field, and it's limited to like a certain period of Gemara Halakha. But they mark off the cases where Minhagos Medina, where like it sounds like almost like all the norm in the jurisdictions that people do this, and they mark seems to defer to the Minhag there. The best example is the sugya in Hazav, I believe,
of Kinesi Tumta. Is there a Kinesi Tumta?
Yeah, so that's how it's often applied. But the Situmta case in the Gemara is what? Yeah, it was marking an X on barrels when they were purchased. So the idea was that the moment you purchase, you would acquire title through like the merchant marking an X on the barrel to like show that it was sold, even though no halachically legitimate kinyan was performed. So the Gemara suggests, and a lot of Rishonim seem to run this idea, it's possible the Gemara, is therefore any socially recognized or any customary form of transaction is valid halachically as well. It doesn't need to have independent halachic legitimacy. So the halacha just incorporates the transactions of the valid transactions of the Medina. So that's a very powerful area where minhag becomes decisive halachically. Okay? Now, this raises an interesting question in the other way. So, suppose I do a halachically valid kinyan that runs contrary to the commercial custom, to the minhag Medina. Would that be valid in your view? Right, so the Situmta case shows that a customary kinyan is sufficient to be a halachically valid kinyan. But what about in the opposite way?
Can you have a negative minhag?
Well?
Can you have such a negative minhag?
Yes. So for example, let's say today, nobody sells real property without transferring a shtar, without drafting a docker. So, do you think maybe I can say, chazaka should be sufficient for a Kenyan karka, or just paying the money should be sufficient? So the Gemara Kedushin suggests, and this is possible by Shulchan Aruch, and we'll talk about this more when we get here, that that's not a valid Kenyan. The Gemara says in the Makom where the minhag is to always convey title to karka b'shtar, Kesef would not be sufficient to convey title, even though halachically it's karka nikneis v'kesef shtar v'hazaka. So again, this just speaks to the powerful influence of minhag even on even against the conventions of pure choshei mishpat. Anybody have questions on that or no? Yoni?
In terms of like making the kinyan together or like halachic revolution,
making the kinyan l'chatchila. Sounds like from the Gemara.
In which case, you're thinking the kinyan itself is like very socially.
Yes. Or at least that the social norms bear on the legitimacy of the pure halachic statutes. Right?
Yeah.
So it's a very, very important question.
I feel like that's like a huge like deal if you don't have like very limited.
Yes. 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 I'll tell you even about this very interesting case where parties had a halachically valid kinyan, like a shtar drafted in Hebrew or something, but it was certainly intention with how you would convey these kinds of high profile real assets in that marketplace. So it's something we'll discuss later on. Okay, in terms of the dispute resolution burden of proof part of the Masechta, so again, we mentioned last time Achlokas Sumchus and the Chachamim, whether generally in the case of the Sufik you say Achloku or Hamotzi Mechaviro of the Raya. What are your intuition? I mean, what should a question like that turn on? Why should the Halacha adopt one rule of disputing, of resolving a conflict? Like Motzi Mechaviro al Raya versus just Yachloku. So what's at the bottom of these disputes? If you look at this sugya on Kuf Aleph Amud Beis, the And ready? Anybody know what
happens on the bottom of the file in the base? Trying to bring my markers or not down
the hall. Is that a shofar being blown again?
Yeah,
oh, for Elo? Is that Valdel Satan?
Last year was like
a
little.
It was all year, right? It was all year. So the Gemara in the Gemara Kaval from Beis talks about a case where this guy needs storage room. It's like Noah's Mishnah Berurah dilemma. Remember Noah's Mishnah Berurah dilemma with his closet? So this guy needed a place to store his barrels, and he wanted to rent the premises of an almana, like a almana storehouse. And she says, no, unless you marry me. So he marries her and puts all his stuff there. And then he divorces her once he got his stuff stored there. So she took out all his stuff and destroyed it. And Amora's trying to figure out, like, was that a legitimate response, like, for her just to destroy all of his stuff? I think Amora ends up saying, oh, kasher asa keni asa lo. He acted deceptively, yeah. And so she can respond in kind. So what kind of a principle is that? Right? It's you don't find that so often in halacha, right? You find the principles, you know, is it a shiamazik? Is it, you know, you say some sort of yachloku or avadin ishtino anafshe? But the Gemara is not even saying that. The Gemara is talking about kasher asa keni asa lo. So does this speak to the possibility of certain, like, extraordinary equitable remedies? You know, like, if the guy just acts so egregiously, then that allows a plaintiff to respond, like, egregiously in kind. You familiar with such a concept? And you don't really see this so often, right? But it makes an appearance in this Gemara in Kofalev. So I want to take a look at that and say, how does this, where does this fit into the different kinds of dispute resolution possibilities that the halacha puts forth. In the sugya on Lamed Tes, Amid Aleph.
This is the notion of ayin tachat ayin with ayin mamish.
You're saying this kind of...
Yeah, if you took ayin literally, then that would be what you're doing, right?
This, yes, except...
I'm not benefiting from putting your ayin away.
Right. This kind of...
You know, poking out one's eye is generally an egregious action.
Right. Right. Except that over there you get the impression that it's more punitive. Right? It's a form of punitive justice. Like, this is what he deserves to correct the wrong that he did. Here in the Gemara it sounds like, oh, he burdened her with all this stuff in a deceptive way. So she can act deceptively to unburden herself from all this stuff. So it sounds more of like kind of relief rather than a punishment.
I mean,
but
story,
I see, right?
The story goes, the formulation.
Yes, correct. The formulation sounds very, right, corrective justice. But I want to take a closer look at that. Interesting. I mean, there's a chiluk there between the chatchil and
b'diavad. Yeah, I guess it's like in terms of conflict resolution, like, where do you do anything afterwards?
Good, that's a very interesting point. Right. Right. Okay, that's a very good point. We should take a closer look at that Gemara when we get there. Because on my reading, this is an important principle of equitable relief. On your reading, it's, oh, but yeah, but we're not going to give the woman trouble if she already did this.
Right, maybe it plays into equitable relief, but it's very, it's like a...
Bidiyevet equitable relief.
Yeah, like a mutative.
Good point. The Sugya and Ayin Tes raises another important concept in terms of the resolution of conflicts and the burden of proof. Does anybody know what happens in Ayin Tes? We saw this last year, actually. So this is a case of a socher who rents... Sorry, a owner has two people working his plow, one person driving the horse and the other person putting the plow into the ground. Anybody remember this? So you have the driver in front. Well, yes, and then the plow breaks. And the Gemara is trying to figure out,
who is negligent? The driver or the person who's in charge of putting the plow in the ground?
So that on, at one point, the Gemara says if it's a very difficult terrain, they're both liable. Unless one party can prove that the other one was solely responsible. So this is a really important principle because it shows that sometimes we reverse the burden of proof. Instead of saying that each party can argue Amosi Mechaber Ola Varaya, or maybe it was the driver who was at fault, and the driver could argue maybe it was the person in charge of the plow, here we reverse the burden of proof and say, no, 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 both of you are presumptively liable unless you can prove that you weren't. See that? This is analogous to
this. This was last year.
But yes, I mentioned we saw this last year. But this is a really fundamental question. When can you reverse the burden of proof and say, usually we say, Amotu Mechaber Ola Varaya, but here you're sufficiently involved that the burden is on you to prove that you weren't responsible. So when can you do that?
Okay. Now the last big topic of the Masechta is the question of ownership.
So what makes somebody an owner in halakha?
And when can they claim that something constitutes their property right versus somebody else's?
So here are the interesting cases that come up in the Masechta.
So on Daf Kuf, the Gemara talks about a case where my trees are uprooted from my property. They're swept downstream, and they take root in your field. And they grow in your field. So, who has title to the fruits? So clearly the Gemara is trying to balance the interests of the person who had grown the trees versus the contribution of the new fields, vitamins, water, etc. So how do you apportion property rights in a case where there's like this kind of joint contribution? Of the more intriguing halachos that come up, we'll have the principle of Yored Tov Sada Shel Chaver Mashbicho.
I trespass and build up your property. So what happens in that case?
What happens in that case? Yeah, or do you know?
Well, I mean, according to the Narsi,
what?
There's the right to
Narsi,
that sounds like you could demand payment for it.
Excellent. Yes, it comes up right at the beginning of our sugya, right? Because when the discrepancy in the pay rate for the poalim, so the Gemara says that the planter, the service provider, can always demand compensation for a benefit they confer, even if it wasn't contracted. Right, the idea is that I go into Yoni's backyard, I landscape his field, so he's liable to pay me for the service even if he didn't request it. I mean, what do you make of that? What underlying theory would explain that principle of either unjust enrichment or restitution? Ben, what do you think? What would explain a principle whereby I'm entitled to compensation even if
you're obligated to compensate me even if you didn't request the service?
You agree with the principle?
No, economic theory is better.
Okay, why an economic theory?
Like society.
What?
Like it's better, like society, the economy is better if you have this.
Productive or something.
Yeah, it's like more productive. So even if the service was requested, like you're still paying for service and rendered.
It's something to think about. I mean, yeah, that's exactly what Yair was saying, right?
Right.
Right, meaning that's 100%. So it's that principle.
That good principle, you think? What underlies that
idea? Do you think it's a peculiar principle, or is it obvious? Yoni, you think it's obvious?
No.
No, right?
No.
Ben, you're the tikva guy, so you should have the...
should be upset. It's like limiting the freedom of the... economic freedom of the... of the law.
Bala Sada.
Right. He should be able to choose whether he wants to live. Who are you to tell me that?
Well, I think the other way of looking at it is from this, you know, you're familiar with Locke's theory of ownership? And you only got a good education. You only, didn't you have a core curriculum? And so, that's right. Well, there's a core curriculum you should know, right? So what's Locke's theory?
I mean, you have, how do people gain titles?
Do some sort of change to it.
Yes, so what kind of change?
A productive change.
So a productive change, okay. And why does a productive change give you ownership over the thing?
Does Locke explain why?
Yes. So Locke says that you own yourself. If you own yourself, you own your labor. And then when you mix your labor into the object, you acquire ownership over it. That's Locke's famous theory for property acquisition in a state of nature. So you might say there's something at work here also in the concept of yored, right? So I own my labor, I mix my labor into your property. That gives me some sort of right to the thing, and you can only gain that, you can only, the only way you can get it from me is if you purchase it, you pay me, you compensate me for the service that I provided. My point here is to show that these halachos of yored and other areas of ownership take important stances on like what the underlying theory of bialis may be. Okay. Here's another important case with respect to our ownership discussions.
So until then, according to that theory, if you won't pay, then you will end up, the planter has the right for the fruits.
Well, the Gemara calls it mamoni gabach. That's right. You're benefiting off my property until you pay me.
He's saying,
who owns the tree? That's what you're asking.
Yeah, the tree becomes very valuable.
Yes. We'll see, when we get to the sugya, there's the possibility that the tree belongs to the poel who planted it. Yeah. So we'll talk about that. So you see, we're going to move from questions of contract and fiduciary relationships of agency through shomrim, etc., into this other area of private law of violence. That's what we're going to come around to more at the end of the month. See that? Over between last day and this day, we're going to cover torts, contracts, and property. Yeah, it's very exciting. Let me mention two other areas of property and ownership that are going to come up at the end of the sefta. So, there's a principle of Ketzad Allah Oses Tora Parasa Shachaviru. The general idea here is what happens when I use your property for my own gain? Who owns the profits? So one crude way of thinking about this, suppose I steal your car and I use it to provide a ride sharing service. I use it as an Uber driver. And I make all these profits off using your car. Who owns those profits? Is the car owner entitled to some of them because his asset partially created the profits? Or does it belong exclusively to the Uber driver? Kind of what you said. Why? Because...
Is this a case of, is it the ego, or is it like...
So it may depend. Very good. Because Geneva may be tricky, because maybe the Ghana requires title.
Yeah.
So then it's his car. We'll see on Lamed Hay this comes up. Does anybody know why this comes up in the Mishnah on Lamed Hay? Important machlokas. I think between our Biyosi, I think, and the Chachamim. Anybody know? Wade, you know offhand?
No.
So it's a case where somebody is socher, I want to say. So they're socher parak, and then they're mashiel it to a third party. And then the animal dies the ones at the hand of the shoel. So a shoel is what for onsen? Chai for onsen. But a socher is pater mi onsen. So does the shoel pay the socher? Or does he pay the original mafkid? Machlokes in the Mishnah. Rabbi Yossi says, of course he pays the original mafkid, because ketzad hala osa eschora b'paraso shel chaveiro. How could the socher make a profit off something that's not his? And then this principle gets used sometimes in these kinds of improper use of somebody else's property case. To say, ketzad hala osa eschora b'paraso shel chaveiro. Whatever profits you made off the improper use of the item has to be forked over to the true violin. So this is an important question about property rights. Good. The last two issues that will come up in property are these complex joint ownership cases, where two people, one person may own certain incidents of the item, and somebody else will own other incidents. So that means one person, let's say, may have a right of use, and somebody else will have a right to transfer. Or one person will have a right to the profits, and somebody else will have control of the principal. So we'll see this relationship in Baal B'Nichse Ishto. Nichse Milug questions, what are the various rights that the husband and wife have in these assets that are brought into the marriage? So the point here is it's not just a shutfus. It's not just a partnership, but it's a way of dividing up the different incidents of ownership. So for example, if the husband or wife is liable to a third party, can one of these mitzvah milut things be taken away to satisfy the debt? And then the last question is something like Yad Eved Kiyad Rabo or Yad Poel Kiyad Balabayas. To what extent can you have true ownership over somebody else's labor? It's like an employee's productive labor belongs to his employer. Okay, Adkan, those are the main topics. Along the way, we'll talk a little bit about Lefnim Mishur Sadin Sugyas, what distinguishes these supererogatory rights and duties from strict rights and duties. And then Mashkon is a sui generis category, but it takes a stand on a lot of these property questions and what rights and duties you have to another party. Okay, that's the long version of what I tried to cram into Tuesday's shiur. Any questions on this? Is everybody game for the plan for this semester, for the year? Ben?
No, I'm
doing
that.
Yes. Okay. So think about this structure. This is what I want to cover. But I'm happy to change it up if you guys have
it. Are you going that order? Or are you like,
yes, we're mostly this order.
We're going this order, right?
Yeah. That's the agenda for the year. Okay. And these are the kinds of issues I want to tease out as we go through the city. Everybody on board? Yeah? Okay. So let's turn now to the philosophical issues that will be important for framing our analysis throughout this month. So there are two broad theories of how to think about private law.
most of the stuff we're discussing this year is all private law, right? Contracts, property ownership.
How should the Bate Din resolve these disputes between the parties? So there are two broad theories about how to think about torts, property, contracts. So Yoni, tell us about the two different schools of thought.
The basic distinction is economic versus rights.
Yeah. So we have these economic views of the law, and then we have these more rights-based views of the law. So tell us a little bit about the economic views of the law.
Well, economic views are primarily just focusing on like what's best for the national or state economy overall. Like what's the best thing? So it's often deterrent-based theories, and then like it's best to want to minimize damage, want to prioritize everything, make it efficient.
Yeah. So the economic views are really looking to considerations of efficiency. Right? How can we make the economy more efficient? How can we deter losses? Can we assign ownership rules and liability rules in such a way as to maximize everyone's well-being, maximize the production of property, and maximize the growth of the economy, et cetera, et cetera. Right? Yeah. So let me just point out, here and there, you do find these economic considerations almost explicitly in the Masechta. So, for example, on Lamed Zayin, the Mishnah talks about a case where two people are mafkid mamon to a shomer. One person gave 200, another person gave 100. Then they get into a dispute as to which one gave the 200. There are different views in the Mishnah. One consideration that the Mishnah has is that if you allow each one to recover 150 zuz, to double check the exact case, so they're worried about ma hipsin haramai. What does the cheater lose by lying? Meaning, you can't just have a liability rule which leaves the cheater at a status quo ante. There has to be some way of deterring him from making the lying claim. So,
what was his economic interpretation, like a sort of moral intuition? Like, it's wrong that the cheater should be able to profit.
Good. So we'll talk about this. That's a very good point. Generally, ideas of deterrence are about, you're saying, so usually you have a deterrence rule that's there to protect the right.
Essentially. No. I'm making sure
a third option.
I wouldn't call it economic theory because it's not asking a question, how do we prevent cheaters from cheating?
You're saying it's we can't.
It's not rights based in the sense that like protecting the right of individual to property. It's morally based. Like,
how can we allow him to?
Yeah.
Interesting. We'll have to take a closer look at the Gemara then, see how the Rishonim fleshes out. Do they say, oh, this way it'll deter him from making the claim in the future? Or are they saying something like you're saying, how could a chote be niskar?
Let's just say our moral intuitions come from frames of efficiency. You think it's wrong for cheaters to prosper because that would just create a bad society that would not work out.
Yeah, that's a possibility also. So when we look at this more closely, then we'll see which view it actually is. At least on the face of it, my hips and our might. My sense is that means he's not deterred from making the specious claim. And the liability rule should also serve as a deterrent. Similar to what we saw in the Rambam and Mor Nebuchim about all the dinim of Nezikin. Another case where this comes up, you'll see throughout the Masechta, the Gemara talks about adopting a certain rule because of its benefits for either Yishuv Haaretz or Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Yishuv Haaretz, according to some Rishonim, doesn't mean Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. It means the settlement of the land, meaning developing property. So, for example, in the sugya of Yored, the Gemara says that if the Yored plants a tree in somebody else's property, he should have to, he's not allowed to pressure the owner and say, oh, if you don't pay me, I'm going to take the tree away. Because that would undermine Yishuv Haaretz. So it sounds like there is a benefit to this thing being built, either a tree planted or a house being built. And because of that general benefit, so we're going to adopt the rule that bars the planter from destroying his creation. You see that? You see that's like a clear economic consideration? Yeah? Yeah. Leib, you see that? So the Gemara is saying that if I build up your churva, your property, so I'm not allowed to destroy it if you don't pay me. So the Gemara says, rather than giving me the option that I could destroy it and walk away, we adopt the rule that we force you to pay me because of this consideration of Yishuv Haaretz. Like, there's an economic interest in there being more buildings and stuff like that. Does that give you...
I mean, it certainly is more economic based, but it's... There also might be, like, very limited in, like, application.
Correct. Correct. I'm just giving a few, like, easy examples where the Gemara is raising these explicitly. It could be that implicitly there are much more of these considerations floating around. So in Dina de Bar Metzra, for example, which we'll talk about, so the Gemara says that a Matzron has the first right to buy a neighboring field that's for sale. And Rashi there says that's because it's more efficient for him to plow two fields that are adjacent in one swoop, than to have to travel to somewhere else to plow a separate field. So that sounds like a clear economic efficiency consideration. And we assign the right to the Matzron to purchase the field because it produces a more efficient result. We'll give more example of this down the line. Let me just point out that it's possible that an economic view might underlie the dispute resolution principle that we may want to adopt. So we saw this machlokas, motzei min chaver al raya versus yachloku. So, do you think these economic considerations may come into play there? So if you remember in the Law and Economics article, so the authors there made an observation about the costs of litigation, the administrative costs of litigation. Well, yeah, what'd they say?
Just that when deciding which, of course, we're deciding what kind of rule to implement, but rules that are more complicated to implement and take longer to implement.
That's right.
Offset economic gains.
Correct. Sometimes in that article, they pointed out that oftentimes the administrative costs of litigating a case are just as expensive, or they eat up as much money as plaintiffs are awarded through the system. Right. So that means the cost of having the system offsets the actual payout of the system. Right. So you might say, well, maybe something like that would bear on whether we adopt the rule of Hamotzei Mechaveru al Varaya versus Yachloku. Right. Certainly Yachloku is a much simpler way of resolving disputes, right? You say, okay, split the baby every time. I'm sure it generates like other problems.
Well, the court also has to get involved, has to evaluate the value of property and...
Yeah, I mean, how much is the Yachloku? Correct. How much is the Yachloku? What?
I thought all of these conflict resolution suggestions, whatever it is, are all like methods of the yunning after the court, after the Kamasa already happens. Like, you already had really gain any administrative costs.
I mean, you're saying that Yachloku will only come about after it's been determined
that there's
a bona fide suffix.
Even if Yachloku was like the solution, we still wouldn't apply right away. You wouldn't say like every time people grab a cup at the same time, right away you split the cup, so you have to go to court.
And you're saying you think that those two would be the same. I think you'd have the same kind of costs to argue about whether, you know, who has the merits on his side if the rule is Yasuo versus.
I mean, I've never been involved in like
making
legal proceedings, but I don't see why they should necessarily be different. Outright.
That's something for us to think about.
But I thought you were going to say that there were like that some of the dispute resolutions tactics themselves more economic than others.
So yeah, you might say even something like a multi mechavira levaraya is just a way of we create a certain threshold of proof in order to have a manageable system.
Right. Or even like Yakov is better than like Muna, no one gets it. Everyone is.
Yeah, but I'll say Munach appears in that Mishnah to create a deterrence for the Ramai.
Okay, but it's still like a thing. It's also in terms of economic theory, like everyone loses out.
Yeah. I hear that. I mean, any of the rest of you have thoughts just in Hakdama mode about where dispute resolution rule would bear on the administrative costs? I guess something that I have in mind is, look, if everybody knows that in a suffix the property is going to be split, then maybe that would just lead them to bypassing the whole litigation in the first place. Just split it.
Maybe, only if they use that in a suffix.
Or they think of it as a suffix. Yeah. Or they think of it as not a big.
Right, so the question is how many cases are the parties really unaware of what kinds of evidence they can deduce to their case?
I mean, like, imagine also, like, divorce cases. Like, even though the rule is typically, like, there's certain standard policies, like, the caretaker usually has a child and money in some way, or gets split in some way. It's like, there still are like, a lot of messy cases.
Right, right. A lot of litigation to figure out who the caretaker is.
The rules are known, they're going to change.
Right.
The rules aren't known. I don't know. If you have those people, what happened in divorce? Very deep question.
Right. It's a good question. In this context.
My guess is maintaining the status quo cost of the court, like after the deliberation. Right, just from that moment, where they're making decisions.
Are there cost savings?
And they're probably saving cost by saying most of it for a ride.
Rather than Yachloku.
It might be better for the economy as a whole to divide businesses, depending on how, socialists you feel about dividing resources. But,
right. Yeah, so this is something to consider. I mean, we'll have a better sense when we look at the Rishonim. Not labeling somebody. So there are a few important, in the Zipersky article, so there are a few important observations about this whole way of thinking about the law as a way of facilitating these economic outcomes. So one thing he points out is that this way of looking at things treats private law as a regulatory enterprise.
We're not really interested in these disputes between two individuals. It's all just a hechatimtzi to fashion liability rules in a way that will create the right kinds of results.
So, he points out, this means that the whole structure of the system is a contingent feature of the system.
So, for example, in halacha, like in secular law, so I have a claim against you. What happens? what do I do if I have a claim against you?
What?
Yeah, you take somebody to Bezdin, right? You take them to court. Now, the whole action is initiated by the plaintiff, by the Tovea. If this is really just about a regulatory enterprise, about like the Rambam says, you want to fashion liability rules in a way to maximally deter bad outcomes, then it's kind of strange that every case has to begin with a plaintiff bringing it to Bezdin. Right? It should be like in criminal law, if there's some state prosecutor that fines you for the wrongdoing. See that?
So he points out it's hard to make sense of this Tovea Nitba Bezdin process if really this is all just a tendency to fashion liability rules in a way that will deter certain outcomes. So the way he puts it, this means that all private law is really public law. There's no real reason for a court to adjudicate between parties. Or another way he puts it is that courts, they just really function as mini legislatures.
There's nothing special about the court adjudicating the rights between the parties. They're just trying to tell you which liability rule will generally create the best outcome overall. Everybody see that?
Yeah, here you have
you don't need to think of the courts in that role. Like the idea of the laws that we choose to implement. Yeah, the legislatures choose those laws and generate those laws.
Well, a lot of this kind of...
Right, I guess you have to have a certain kind of formalism that says, once we have these laws that are geared towards maximizing economic well-being, we apply those laws as consistently as possible.
Yeah, but he's saying that most tort laws aren't created by statute. Same thing for most contracts.
Right.
Okay. So these are all common law principles that just evolve through the court system separately. And in halacha, you get a similar sense also, right? I mean, these are cases that are paskin and then get codified in Shulchan Aruch a certain way.
I guess, learning about that is you have a lot of stories generate the rules.
Yeah, I mean, that's how most of halacha is. Like, the analogy is the common law, not the legislation.
That argument doesn't really go well with the rights based.
So let's get to the rights based view in a second. So on this whole view, we'd be looking at the system of employer-employee relationships, contracts, property, as just ways of generating the right kinds of outcomes. Right, the most economically efficient outcomes. So what's the alternative way of looking at this? So Yair, what's the alternative way of going about this?
The first key in Kroll, so...
You liked him?
I did.
Okay.
They're going to do a good job of identifying the role of plaintiff,
Asserting his right.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah.
So give us the general wine rib. What? Because wine rib is the one who developed the alternative here to the economic point of view.
Right.
So you know what's going on there?
Blueprint. Wine rib, she's done this is the laws aren't based on, code of style lawfare, but based on right that individuals hold in, their property. And, when a person damages your property or causes you harm in some way, this, rights-based relationship is created where he now owes me. It's right for him to pay me.
Yes, I think even more than that. So the Weiner view is that he calls this formalism. Now he calls it formalism because he thinks that private law has a certain form. Right, what's the form? The form is this very special plaintiff-defendant relationship. The Tovea Nitba relationship. That's why he sees it like the form of the dispute. Now, he says something really radical. And he says, not only is it this special plaintiff-defendant relationship, it has to be a perfectly coherent and uniform relationship. Sometimes he calls this a bipolar relationship. Meaning, it's one kind of relationship that binds the two parties. So he gives this really great example. where he says, commonly people think about Nazikin or tort law as combining deterrence for the defendant, right? So you want to make sure that you want to deter the mazik, like the Rambam said. That's why we make him pay. Plus compensation for the plaintiff. Right? Two separate goals. Right? A deterrence goal for the defendant and a compensation goal for the plaintiff. He says that's not a true private law relationship because there's no internal connection between the goal of compensation to compensate somebody for their loss and the goal of deterring somebody from destroying property. See that? It's a very interesting view. He's saying there has to be one explanation for why the mazik pays and why the nizak gains. And we have two different considerations, like compensation for loss plus deterrence, then there's no coherence between the two different sides of the courtroom. That's like the wine rev, that's like the hyper-formalism that he's trying to get at. Now, the way he tries to flesh out this idea of bipolarity is the correlativity of harm done and harm suffered. So, the wrongfulness of causing harm is the reason why the person who suffers the harm deserves to be compensated. Okay? Now, to flesh that out further, he calls this the correlativity of harm done and harm suffered. So we're looking for a framework, this is how Weinberg sets it up, where actions of the plaintiff, wrongful actions of the defendant are correlative of rights to the plaintiff. See, that's what Weinberg's looking for. Like, how can we have a more precise characterization of the coherent relationship between the parties? Am I falling back into his abstract formulations, or did I make this a little more clear?
It's clearer.
Clearer. Okay. Now, the question is, how do we get there? How do we flesh out this correlativity? So notice immediately, in contrast to the economic school, which is just interested in well-being overall, Weiner says, well, we're looking for the moral reasons for relating one person to another through a set of legal concepts. Right? So he thinks that the law is animated by moral considerations. I think it's almost a truism in halacha to say that, of course, the way these disputes are adjudicated is to try to figure out the moral reasons on either side. It's almost like the Rambam said in Mor Nebuchim with respect to Bav Metzia cases. Right? We're trying to figure out what's equitable, what's fair in the relationship between the parties. So, how do we flesh that out? So here, Weinberg makes an interesting move. So here's where I take issue slightly with Yair's formulation. He says, we have to look to the conceptual structure of free agency. So what he means by that is, look, we're all free people in the world. We are rational beings who are, let's say, to use the more metaphysically loaded terminology, so we're endowed with Tselem Elokim that gives us free agency to decide what to do and how to conduct our lives. And that translates into certain norms about how my Tselem Elokim or my agency can cohere with your agency and your Tselem Elokim and your decision, your rights to act freely. This is Weiner's move. With me?
I didn't get that.
So he's saying, look, we're all special creatures, right? We're endowed. He's appealing to a Kantian term of what he calls a conceptual structure of agency. Right? Agency is the code word for
this freedom, rationality, what makes humans special, and the capacity to make decisions on your own. And so there's got to be a rule or a system of rules that governs how my agency can be made consistent with your agency. Right? Meaning I'm allowed to do things, you're allowed to do things as a rational and special being. Right? So he says that this whole history of natural right, he appeals to Kant and Hegel, I think it goes to Aquinas, are the totality of norms governing the interaction of free and purposive agents.
So if you think about it, like the world is just inhabited by these very special beings that imposes certain rights and obligations on the people in the world to carve up the space around them in a way that preserves each other's freedom and each other's like special nature. That's the move that he's making. Got that?
Okay.
With me?
Okay. That sounds
like it's rather intuitive. What? It's like a complicated way to answer.
He's just trying to be as explicit as possible as to like what he's. Yes, but he's saying rights emanate from like people's special nature as rational agents.
Yeah, okay. I feel like that's a good comment.
Yeah, you might say it's like that's what it means to be human.
Yeah, so
right?
Well, if you ask what's on the street, you get the same thing.
What?
Like you get some response from like people on the street.
So that's very different from the
certainly different from the economic view.
Sort of, I guess it like sets up the structure for the economic ones to be more of like utilitarian, nil.
100%. Right. So here's a great quote. Some of this is one of the phrases here is taken from Metaphysics of Morals. So look what he says. Corrective justice is an expression of the principle of right under which the action of one freely willing person is co-joined to the freedom of another in accordance with the universal law. Right? So these rights are just a way to navigate between my freedom and where it comes into conflict with your freedom. And you're saying that's intuitive. Right.
I mean, you don't have to disagree, but I think
it's way
more people
would think
with rights.
Yeah. So now here's where he flushes it out further. He says, because freedom manifests itself juridically in rights that others are obligated not to violate, so
this way of carving up space of one person's freedom co-joining with the freedom of another in a way that's fair, then manifests itself in a system of law. But it manifests itself juridically in rights that others are obligated not to violate. And says this is what generates the corrective justice system and a normative regime of correlative right and duty.
So what we mean by rights and duties is just this way of carving up the space of freedom between my freedom and your freedom. Now this is the crucial phrase. So a normative regime of correlative right and duty.
Everybody appreciates what Weinberg done so far? Yeah, or not appreciate, get a handle on it? Okay. So he's saying because this is the nature of private law, so rights are a way of navigating my space in the world against your space in the world. So that means we're going to have a regime of correlative rights and duties. What does he mean by that? And you can see here he's really pointing to Hovel. Okay?
We're going to stop in 1 second.
But,
very correlated. The right connected rights and duties are like intrinsically linked.
Yes, they're analytically linked together.
Yeah. That was Hovel said that a right is something that you don't have a duty not to do?
Well, that's a privilege. But rights, in the sense that we're going to talk about the whole health analysis soon, rights are correlative of duties. So for me to hold a right against you just means that you owe a duty to me. And for me to owe a duty to you just means that you hold a certain right against me. This is important for what he wants to set up as this formal structure of private law is a bipolar relationship between plaintiff and defendant. Right? If I violate my duty, I ipso facto violated your right, and vice versa. So we're just interlocked in this game where wrongs, by definition, violate somebody's rights. And so we're always locked in this private law relationship with each other. So I wanted to just take, I want to make 2 points here. And we'll pick up with this thread on Tuesday. The first point is to take issue with Yair's otherwise very good description of Weinreb.
And that is, it's not that courts,
it's not that the right becomes relevant when the court tries to impose a penalty. The rights and duties are all antecedent to the legal system. They're before the courts get involved. They just exist in the relationships that we have with each other. Right? So courts don't create rights. They don't impose rights. They just vindicate them when they've been antecedently violated. So the rights and duties thing is nothing to do with the court system. The court just tries to weigh in and try to solve rights violations. But they exist as like features of the world, so to speak.
But wouldn't you say that because it's in the statutory law, the common law, and the way the courts have interpreted it itself?
So he's saying, no, the courts are just trying to figure out like what the boundaries of like my freedom against your freedom.
Yeah, so they're legislating the facts. What boundaries?
Except they started in the court derives from the more
fundamental. Right.
Okay, but still
compare that to the economic. Compare that to the economic view, where the courts are just like actively trying to fashion the right, most efficient rules, liability.
And you all think that the equivalent of that here, they're effectively fashioning the rights and duties.
Yeah, they're just trying to like figure out exactly.
Well, they're defining which ones are right, where the rights and duties start and where they end.
Maybe they're like persistifying or something, but like they don't have an active role in
this. Well, isn't the whole work? And then, like, he said it's a great thing, like the rights and duties, that, you know, but the whole work now is finding out where that line is, like where the rights and where the duties
start. Yeah.
So, like, that's, but like that work is like the most significant part, that's what the courts are doing. So the courts are just as legislative.
It's an interesting question. I think he would just say they're applying these rights and duties to specific cases.
Like, I think the person had a good way of putting it, where he said that the economic view is forward-looking. They're trying to like fashion the law in an efficient way. And the rights-based view is backward-looking. Right? It's just trying to rectify. Yeah, exactly. Figure out exactly where the violation was. Looking back. So that's the first point I want to make. That this works very nice with other indigenous inache, where of course like the rights violation is totally independent of any court involvement. We'll talk more about that.
The second observation, and with this we conclude, is the correlativity of the right and the duty.
And I mean, this is where that article by Wilkinson and Kober just get it wrong. You know, they make a big deal about, oh, halacha is much more duty focused rather than rights focused.
There's an intuitive sense where they're tapping onto a good point about the system, but I think it's wrong as applied to these kinds of tovei nitva relationships that we'll be discussing throughout the year. To violate a duty is to violate someone's right. To have a right means that somebody else has a duty owed to you. So there's no real meaningful distinction between the two. The difference is which perspective are you looking at it from? From one party side or the other party side? So we're going to talk more about there. So there are 2 points that we'll discuss based on this in Hofeld. The first point is to what extent the duties and rights are correlative of each other. And then the second point is a more precise accounting of the different kinds of rights that exist, which is Hofeld's real contribution. Actually, this will be a very powerful framework for the stuff we're going to see throughout the year. Okay, so we're going to stop here, and we'll pick up on Tuesday.